My purpose today is twofold. First, to describe some of the broad changes taking place in Montana's economy, and then to provide an overview of the tax system. But first, do you know what emeritus means? I asked this question at a presentation to a legislative committee in January. Unfortunately, some of my so-called friends, people with whom I have worked for many years, were in the peanut gallery behind me. They started yelling, "Over the hill! It means you're really old!" and other wonderful comments. The committee was taken by surprise and didn't know what to say, but everyone started laughing. And it turned out to be one of the best presentations I've ever done because the ice was broken and everyone felt free to ask questions. Unfortunately, with the technology we're using today, you need to submit those questions via the chat box. So what does emeritus actually mean? It's an honorific bestowed on some retired professors by the Board of Regents of the university system. The bar is pretty low, I must say. But coincidentally, the first version of this presentation to you today was delivered to a Board of Regents meeting in Missoula in the early 2000s. Fortunately, it was well received. Well, that didn't work. Hang on a second. There we go. This first chart shows Montana's income per person as a percentage of the national average. As you can see, back in 1950, incomes were about 10% above average. But incomes declined in a relative sense very rapidly after that, to about 85% of the national average by the late 1960s. During the 1970s, this trend was reversed, with incomes rising to 95% of the US average. But by the middle 1980s, things turned down again, and incomes fell to as low as 75% of the national average. Incomes have increased since 2000 and sit at 87% of the national average in 2018. So why are Montana's incomes below average? And what can explain these rather dramatic ups and downs in relative incomes over the last 70 years? A big part of the answer is fairly simple. But first, remember that this chart displays relative, not absolute income. The second chart shows absolute incomes per person adjusted for inflation. By almost any reasonable standard, Montanans have higher real incomes than they did 70 years ago. More cars, let's see, I remember in the 1950s, it was one car for every four people. Now it's one car for every two people. Bigger houses, even though we have smaller families, better health care, and so forth and so on. But although Montana incomes have grown in absolute terms, they have grown more slowly than in the country as a whole, and hence they have declined in a relative sense. So the question remains, why have Montana incomes failed to keep up with national averages? This chart shows what has happened to the prices of what traditionally have been some of Montana's most important products. The blue line is an overall price index for farm output. The red line displays prices for crude materials, a broader index that includes the output of mines, oil and gas wells, and other natural resource products, in addition to farm products. Historically, these have been vital sectors in the Montana economy, and understanding what has happened in these markets is important for understanding what has happened to Montana incomes. These are real prices, meaning that they measure prices received by producers relative to the consumer price index. As you can see, prices received by farmers have fallen by almost two-thirds since 1950, in comparison with the prices of typical consumer goods. Put differently, it takes three times as much farm output to buy a basket of consumer goods today than it did in 1950. One exception is the period from the early 1970s to the early 1980s, when the world was supposedly running out of food and energy. Scarcity, partly induced by OPEC, partly a result of other forces, made prices high And as we just saw, these were relatively good years for Montana. In the last two decades, we again saw high oil prices and the development of fracking. Parts of eastern Montana boomed as a result. There also was a period of high farm prices in around 2013, but the long-term trend has been toward lower prices for crude materials. In short, falling prices for some of Montana's traditional products help to explain why incomes have fallen relative to national averages. Working in the opposite direction, the last 70 years saw tremendous technological advancements and capital investment, which improved output per worker in many industries. For example, in agriculture, new technologies, wheat seeds, herbicides, pesticides, new farming methods, approximately doubled wheat yields over this time period. In fact, the very reason that prices have fallen so much is the enormous productivity increases, which increased supply. Thus, while prices fell, output actually increased sharply in agriculture. The net result has been that gross cash receipts of Montana agriculture are about the same as they were 70 years ago, after adjustment for inflation. The blue line shows livestock receipts, the orange line adds receipts from crops, and the purple line adds government payments. As you can see, total receipts have run $3 to $4 billion per year, again, with the notable exceptions in the 1970s and early 2010s. As we are about to see, agriculture has declined in relative importance, but it remains a vitally important sector. For example, while cash receipts in agriculture show no long-term trend, tourism has grown enormously, from very little in the early years to $3.7 billion in 2018. So we can look at that. There it is on the chart. It's very similar to the total take from agriculture. Despite the growth in agricultural output, employment has declined, principally because, again, technological advances and capital investment have made it possible to produce a bushel of wheat or a pound of beef with a whole lot less labor than 70 years ago. As this chart shows, in 1950, almost one-fourth of all the jobs in Montana were in agriculture, forestry, or fishing. Now the percentage is about 6%. Similar trends have occurred in some of the other basic industries. Mining employment has declined from 4% to 2%. Manufacturing from 8% to 4%, and transportation and public utilities from 10% to 4%. In many cases, there have been changes in the kinds of jobs within these sectors as well. For example, metal smelting and refining, a subsector of manufacturing, has largely disappeared along with most of Montana's smelters. While manufacturing today includes high-tech firms and a variety of other non-traditional industries. A bit more about that later. A related way of looking at the economy is to examine where people get their incomes. This chart shows the sources of income in Montana and how they have changed in the last 70 years. Personal income is a broad measure of income that includes not just wages and salaries, but also benefits such as employer-provided health insurance or retirement contributions, and also self-employment income, dividends, interests, and rents, sometimes called capital income, and transfer payments. As you can see, dividends, interests, and rents have increased in importance from about 11% of income to about 25%. This reflects, in part, an aging population, which is more likely to rely on capital income than the working age population. More on demographics in a minute. Similarly, transfer payments have grown from 11% of income to about 19%. About 60% of transfer payments are to the elderly, largely Social Security and Medicare. About 25% of transfers are hardship related, including Medicaid, unemployment compensation, and other kinds of welfare. And 15% are for other programs, including, for example, veterans benefits. The share of personal income derived from employment has declined from 84 to 56%, mainly because of the growth in the other two categories. So if we focus now on the employment category, what are the largest industries in Montana as measured by labor earnings? Well, it turns out that the largest industry in Montana with more than $6 billion in labor earnings is government. This is about one-fifth of the total over all the industries. About 30% of government earnings in Montana are paid to federal employees, 20% to employees of state government, and the remaining 50% to local government, including municipalities and education. In fact, for many decades, K through 12 education has been the largest socialized industry in the U.S., according to the classic definition of socialism as government production. In the last couple of years, as well as back during the Cold War era, defense spending has given K-12 education a run for top dog. Looking over the remaining industries, healthcare is next, followed by wholesale and retail trade, construction, finance, insurance, and real estate, professional and technical services, lodging and food services, manufacturing, transportation and warehousing, and other services. Mining rounds out the top 10 with a bit over $1 billion in labor earnings. There are more industries, but only 10 fit on the chart, and these account for 90% of total labor earnings in Montana. One other thing to notice is the importance of service industries indicated by an asterisk. These include everything from retail sales clerks and burger flippers to doctors, lawyers, and accountants. By the way, some people say we don't make anything in the US anymore, but the reality is we make more stuff than ever before. However, technology has made us so good at making things with machines that relatively few people are employed in goods producing industries. Montana also has a growing high-tech sector, which cuts across conventional definitions of what constitutes an industry. The definition used here includes firms that either employ a high proportion of scientists, engineers, and technicians, or had a high proportion of research and development employment, or produced a high-tech product, or used high-tech production methods. I would say we are using a high-tech method to produce this lecture today. The first line shows total wages in high-tech industries of about $1 billion per year, which is just a bit less than mining in the previous slide. Employment of 15,000 people is about 3% of Montana's workforce. The number of firms grew rapidly between 2017 and 18. 12% is a big jump for 1 year. The wages per job are very high at almost $70,000. And they are second highest only to mining in the Montana economy. Finally, most of the firms are very small, averaging only about 6 workers per business. Summarizing, high-tech industries are currently a relatively small part of the Montana economy, with exceptionally high-paying jobs, and in those regards, it's similar to mining. One difference may be the future trajectory, which is probably brighter for high-tech than it is for mining. A recent survey of high-tech entrepreneurs in Montana revealed some interesting comments about Montana as a place to do business. On the pro side, the entrepreneurs praised the quality of life in general. Montana is a great place to live, outdoor recreation, so forth and so on. They also praised the quality of the workforce. Several of them mentioned some sort of a notion of a Montana work ethic, which they regarded as being exceptionally fine. On the con side, the entrepreneurs feel that access to capital, which they need to grow, expand their businesses, is limited. The quality of workers is great, but the availability is not enormous. And then finally, Montana is a small market, so there's a lack of customers for the products. And as a producer in Montana, there's a lack of nationwide visibility. So Montana has both strengths and weaknesses as a place to do high-tech business. Notice that taxes are not frequently mentioned either on the pro or the con side. I'll talk more about that in the second half. I have three slides on Montana demographics, and then I'll conclude the first part of the talk. First, Montana is an old state. That's one reason transfer payments, such as Social Security and Medicare, are such a large fraction of personal income. Secondly, Montana is expected to get even older in the next decade. As you can see, the proportion of the population age 65 plus is supposed to reach 23% by 2030. And then it turns out that these demographic trends differ somewhat between urban and rural areas, and they're affected by migration as well. That's the subject of the next two slides. So this is a tough slide if you're looking on your phone, or maybe even if you're on your iPad, but it turns out that most of the information is in the colors here. These charts display projections of population growth from 2000 to 2030, broken down by county and by age. Green counties are growing, and the darker the green, the faster they're growing. And the blue counties are shrinking, that is, a decline in population. So look at the upper left-hand panel first. This refers to total population of all ages. There is a large swath of blue across the northern part of Montana, indicating that the total population is declining in that area. The fastest growing county you can see down here is Gallatin, and most of the other counties in southwest Montana are also green, that is to say growing. The upper right panel shows what's happening to the youth population, age 0 to 17. Here, most of the state is blue. You may know that the number of students graduating from high school in Montana peaked in the late 1990s, and current numbers of graduates are down about 15% from the peak. Bozeman is a real outlier, building a second high school while much of the state is just trying to hold on to one, but sometimes having to merge with a neighboring district. Perhaps some of you grew up with that experience. The lower left-hand panel shows the working age population, 18 to 64. It is similar to, but not quite as blue as the youth map, indicating that the working age population is declining in most of the counties in Montana. Finally, the lower right-hand panel shows the population age 65 plus. Almost every county is green, which reflects the growing elderly population in almost all of Montana. Finally, note that Gallatin County is the darkest green on all of these maps. In other words, it has the fastest growing population of all the counties in all age categories. No wonder they call it Bozangeles. The population changes on the previous slide are partly driven by natural changes, that is, births and deaths. But migration also plays an important role. Net migration is the number of people moving into an area minus the number of people moving out. So it can be positive or negative. These panels show net migration by age, by actually single year of age, over the period 2011 to 2020. The upper panel shows Montana's seven urban counties. So let's see. This is a test. Can you name them? Yellowstone, Gallatin, Butte, Lewis and Clark, Cascade, the hated Missoula, and Flathead. The chart shows positive net migration into these counties for every age group, except for some reason, 31 to 34, with especially heavy in-migration of people 18 to 30. In other words, young people are going to the cities. In contrast, the lower panel shows that the remaining 49 counties are mostly losing more young people than they are gaining. Many leave to go to college or seek work when they are 18 to 21. Some go back home after college, but more of them end up leaving when they are in their late 20s. These slides are intended to emphasize the differences between what's going on in Montana's urban and rural counties, with the former seeing population growth, especially among young people, while the latter mostly see their young people leave. Sometimes it's called the urban-rural gap in Montana, and it's real. Let me summarize before taking a few questions and then moving on to talk about taxes. We've discussed some of the long-term trends that have shaped and continue to shape the Montana economy. These include declining real prices for primary products, which traditionally were the backbone of the Montana economy. Labor-saving technical change, especially in goods-producing industries, which has reduced costs of production, but also employment in those industries. Instead, employment has shifted to services. The growing importance of capital income and transfer payments. Looking ahead to the next part of the talk, is our tax system aligned with these income sources? A high-tech sector is developing, but so far it is fairly small, about the same as mining. Finally, the urban-rural divide, especially in terms of demographics. So taxes are a controversial public policy issue in every legislative session, as well as many bars that I've been in. There are many anecdotes about Montana taxes, whether they are high or low, rising or falling, whether certain taxes, such as the property tax or the income tax, are high or low, how that affects our business climate. The main purpose of this talk is to provide a factual basis for informed discussion of these issues. At the end of the talk, there is a brief assessment, that's one slide, of where Montana stands today and where we might go from here. So most people think of taxes as how we pay for government. But in fact, state and local taxes amount to less than half of total state and local government revenues. As you can see in this chart, in fiscal year 17, the proportion was 44%. The second largest source is transfers from the federal government to state and local governments. In the early 1970s, these transfers were largely for highways, and in particular for the completion of the interstate highway system. We still get lots of money for roads, but the largest portion is now for human services, programs like Medicaid, and also for education and other kinds of programs. The third source is fees and miscellaneous revenues, which include charges for everything from water and sewer to hunting licenses and camping fees. So think for a moment here. What do you think is the largest single source of fee revenue in the state? I'll give you a hint. I told you I gave this presentation to the Board of Regents in the early 2000s, and I asked them the same question. And the answer is, it's the university system, including both tuition and fees, and also food and housing in the dorms. But don't be bothered if you didn't know the answer. The Board of Regents didn't know the answer either. Turning now to taxes themselves, before discussing the numbers, it is worth taking a moment to consider what might be considered a good tax system. First, a good tax system is one that promotes economic opportunity. For many years, Montanans have seen large numbers of young people not just moving to cities, but leaving the entire state for better opportunities elsewhere. And most of us that were working here wouldn't mind an increase in our own incomes as well. to the extent that a tax system can improve that situation, or at least not discourage opportunity, it is desirable. A second criterion for evaluating a tax system is fairness. This has to do with who bears the burden of paying taxes. It is very difficult to pin down exactly what constitutes a fair tax system. In fact, most people's definition of a fair tax is one that somebody else pays. Yeah, see, that's I need that feedback there. I need the laughter. And of course, this accounts for the popularity of taxes on tourists. But even if it is hard to precisely define fairness, it is an important element in judging a tax system. A third factor is low administrative and compliance costs. These are the costs borne by the government in collecting taxes, and also the costs borne by the private sector in complying with the tax code. Around April 15th in most years, maybe not this year, many people are acutely aware that the costs of complying with the tax code are not just the money we finally send to the government. A fourth factor is stability. The Montana legislature was called back into a special session in the fall of 2017, only 6 months after it had adjourned, not expecting to return for 21 months. The primary reason for the special session was that tax revenues had fallen short of projections. The special session cut planned expenditures for mental health, nursing homes, and other programs, shifted funds around, and eventually balanced the budget, as is required by the state constitution. Similar issues arose after the 2001 recession and the Great Recession of 2009. When revenues fluctuate dramatically, it creates problems for managing the public finances. A final criterion for a good tax system is that it should provide adequate revenues. In fact, if you think about it, revenues to fund government services are just about the only good thing about taxes. Taxes themselves are more likely to discourage economic opportunity than to promote it. Fairness is extremely difficult to achieve. All taxes have substantial administrative and compliance costs. If it weren't for the public safety, the roads, the schools, the healthcare, and the other services that are provided by taxes, if it weren't for the public safety, roads, schools, healthcare, and Bobby, we need a mute.
Yep, getting there. Thank you.
If it weren't for the public safety, the third time, if it weren't for the public safety, roads, schools, healthcare, and other services that are provided by taxes, we could just go home and forget the whole thing. Wouldn't that be nice? Another important question is whether taxes are, in fact, important for economic growth and opportunity. And the answer is that yes, taxes are one of the factors that influence location decisions. But taxes are not the only influence, or in most cases, even the most important. Other important factors include distance to markets, or historically for Montana, nearness to natural resources. As we heard from the entrepreneurs, the availability, wages, and skills of labor and capital. The regulatory climate. Amenities is a very broad term encompassing the crime rate, the quality of the public services like schools, and even the climate. Many of us here in Montana are very fond of the outdoor activities, including hunting and fishing, hiking and skiing, and so forth. But sometimes we have to remind ourselves that many people, maybe even a majority of people, prefer to have less than 6 months of winter. Well, public policy can't do much about the weather, at least in the short run, but taxes are something that we can all control. So it's worth taking a hard look at Montana's tax structure. Let's look first at total state and local taxes. That is property taxes, whether levied on residential, commercial, industrial, agricultural, or any other kind of property, personal and corporate income taxes, all kinds of sales and excise taxes, severance and other taxes levied on natural resources. In short, all of the state and local taxes, including those levied by the state, counties, towns and cities, school districts, right down to mosquito control districts. So are Montana's taxes high? Well, I got a chart here with a whole bunch of numbers on it. I'm going to spend a bit of time going through this because there's a few more charts that have this same format, and then you'll be able to quickly digest them. This chart displays total taxes for 2017. Make sure we understand, we're talking about state and local taxes here. These amounted to almost $3,900 per person in Montana, which ranks us 40th from the top and well below the national average of $5,073. Idaho's taxes are a bit lower. North Dakota's at $6,600 were among the highest in the country, and South Dakota's a bit higher than Montana. Wyoming's taxes were close to average on a per person basis. Another way of looking at taxes on the right-hand portion of the table is as a percentage of income. This is an attractive idea, both because income is a measure of ability to pay, and because income drives the demand for the quality and quantity of public services, such as roads and schools. Montana taxes amount to 8.5% of personal income in the state for a ranking of 39th highest, and again below the national average of 9.8%. Idaho's were similar to Montana's, and North Dakota's taxes as a percentage of income were the second highest in the country. South Dakota's taxes were below average, and Wyoming was among the lowest in the country as a percentage of income. One has to be very careful with data like this because total taxes include taxes that most people don't pay, at least not directly. In particular, these rankings reflect the importance of natural resource revenues in the various states. North Dakota continues to benefit from the boom in the Bakken, which has allowed them to actually reduce some of the other taxes that people do pay directly, such as their income tax rate. In prior years, both Montana and Wyoming benefited enormously from resource taxes. I guess, you know, as long as I disclosed how old I am, the first time I showed a table like this was 1986. And in that table, Montana was the fifth highest in the country in terms of total taxes. And what was it? It was natural resource taxes. So total taxes do not necessarily reflect the burdens that most people directly pay. A related question is whether taxes are rising in Montana. Montana taxes have increased in nominal or dollar value over the years, but fallen as a percentage of income. Total taxes averaged 10.9% of personal income during the 1970s and early 1980s, but fell to 9.1% during the current decade. However, many Montanans didn't see a decline in the taxes they personally pay because much of the decline in total taxes resulted from the fall in natural resource tax revenues. There's a theme here. Here's more on the theme. This chart shows Montana's tax revenues from natural resources since 1980, expressed as a percentage of personal income. They were highest back in the early 1980s. However, resource revenues declined abruptly after what at that time we called the end of the energy crisis in 1986, had a partial resurgence around 2008 when oil exceeded $100 per barrel, but recently have been much lower. Put differently, natural resource taxes in the early 1980s accounted for as much as 1 in 4 of all state and local tax dollars, but in recent years have accounted for only 1 in 15 total tax dollars. Put one more way, the resource taxes collected in the early 1980s were, on a per person basis, about the amount that a typical state received from its general sales tax. Some people said that resource taxes were our sales tax here in Montana. Another question that is heard frequently around the state of Montana these days and in the legislature in particular is, whether Montana relies too much on the property tax. This slide describes the composition of taxes in Montana in comparison with a typical state. As you can see, Montana gets 41% of its tax revenues from the property tax, while a typical state gets only 32%. Montana does not have a general sales tax, but it does levy a variety of excise or selective sales taxes. These are sometimes known as sin taxes. And in Montana, the big sins apparently are tobacco, alcohol, gasoline, and motel rooms. I always get a laugh out of that one. Actually, taxes on insurance policies are another large source, and taxes on public utilities yield more revenue than taxes on alcohol, but they're not nearly as much fun to talk about. Still, when general and selective sales taxes are added together, Montana gets less than half as much from these sources as a typical state does. Montana relies relatively heavily on personal and corporate income taxes, which provide about 32% of total tax revenues, above the national average of 26%. Finally, Montana gets more taxes from other sources than a typical state. These include motor vehicle taxes and natural resource taxes. And while Montana's natural resource revenues are much diminished from 35 years ago, they are still more than a typical state. Whenever people see the previous slide, they say, "I knew my property taxes were too high." But the data suggests that Montana's average effective tax rates on residential property are well below national averages and near the midpoint for states in the region. Average is an important word here because property taxes vary dramatically around the state. Property values and mill levies vary across school districts, counties, cities, and other taxing districts. The effective tax rates displayed in the table are the property tax bill divided by the market value of the property, what it would sell for in an arm's length transaction between a willing and an informed buyer and seller. This slide actually displays two sets of estimates, one from the Tax Foundation and another from the Minnesota Center for Fiscal Excellence. Let's not get too deep into them. They use two different methodologies, which I could explain ad nauseum. I'll try to avoid that. Look in the upper left-hand corner. The Tax Foundation says the average effective tax rate in Montana is 0.73%. And it turns out that's almost exactly what I pay in property taxes as a percentage of the market value of my home, which is located just outside the city limits of Bozeman. Notice that that ranks us 33rd highest and well below the national average of 1.05%, about a third less. The Minnesota Center uses a different methodology. They look at the largest city in each state, so it's got municipal taxes in there. But look at the number. They come up with a larger number. It is 0.94% of the market value of the property. And that ranks us 40th from the top in the country. I guess that'd be 11th lowest. And again, compared with the national average, we are about one-third less than the national average in terms of the effective property tax rate. So both sets of estimates suggest that Montana's average effective tax rates are well below national averages and near the midpoint for states in the region. While effective residential property tax rates are low, many citizens are concerned with how fast their property tax bills are rising. This chart shows property taxes, including SIDs and fees, as a percentage of personal income. Perhaps surprisingly, personal income in Montana increased faster than total property taxes over this 24-year period here in the chart. So total property taxes have fallen as a percentage of income from 4.5% to 3.9%. This may not jibe with your perception of what has happened, because people are most aware of the taxes they pay In other words, residential property taxes. As the green bars indicate, taxes on residential property increased faster than income, rising from 1.5% to 2%. So how should we think about residential property taxes? We have seen that average effective rates on residential property are low in comparison with national average. But most homeowners don't care what people pay in other states. They are concerned with the fact that their property tax bill is going up. It's also true that some homeowners faced with rising property tax bills are benefiting from increased wealth as their homes appreciate in value. But rising home values don't provide cash flow to pay higher property tax bills. Thus, rising property tax bills are a concern for many people, especially those on fixed incomes. Continuing to talk about property taxes, it is our largest tax. What about property taxes on industrial property? The estimated effective tax rates are even lower than residential for small industrial properties, but higher for larger industrial properties, as this slide shows. The small property is based on $100,000 of land and buildings, while the large property is based on $25 million of land and buildings. In addition to the real estate values, each property is assumed to have machinery and equipment, inventories and fixtures, which are taxable at various rates in some states. The bottom line is that Montana's effective tax rate on the small industrial property is less than half the national average and lower than the other states in the region, except for North Dakota. I might mention one, I was asked a question, which you can't do here. What kind of a industrial property has $100,000 of real estate value? And the answer is there are a lot of small businesses in Montana that operate out of sheds or garages on people's property. They make leather belts, they can huckleberries. There are a lot of small properties, and they are very different than the large properties. The Montana's effective tax rate on the large industrial property is slightly below the national average and higher than the other states in the region. In fact, look there, it's twice as high as some of the neighboring states. Look at our effective tax rate is 1.25% on the large industrial property. In Wyoming, it's 0.63%. Let me briefly describe Montana's income taxes in comparison with other states. We have already seen that Montana receives a larger share of its tax revenues from income taxes than a typical state does. Here are some additional facts. The personal income taxes as a percentage of income are the 20th highest in the country, so above the median. The top income tax rate of 6.9% is the 14th highest in the country. For comparison, Idaho is just a tiny bit higher at 6.925%, and North Dakota is at 2.9%. Wyoming and South Dakota don't have, neither Wyoming nor South Dakota has an income tax, either for individuals or for corporations. The Montana individual income tax has a large number of modifications, deductions, exclusions, which both reduce the size of the tax base and also make it more complex to administer and simply comply with. Montana's corporate income tax is about average among states that have a corporate income tax. Well, obviously not average in comparison with Wyoming and South Dakota. So what does all this mean in terms of encouraging or discouraging business in Montana and therefore economic opportunity? The overall level of taxation is below average, but Montana relies relatively heavily on property and income taxes. On the other hand, Montana does not have a general sales tax, a significant part of which is paid by business in many states. The Tax Foundation has combined information on all these taxes into an index of business tax climate and included the unemployment insurance tax as well. As the chart shows, Montana has the fifth best overall business tax climate, behind South Dakota, third best, and Wyoming first, according to the Tax Foundation. However, the Tax Foundation Index has been criticized because it is qualitative rather than quantitative. It's also not transparent. Nobody knows really how they come up with it, and seems to place a large emphasis on the absence of a tax. The sales tax for Montana and the income tax for South Dakota and Wyoming. And there are other evaluations of state business tax climate which show a different picture for Montana. The first column in this table repeats the Tax Foundation ranking. The next column refers to a study a few years ago by the Council on State Taxation. They are another bona fide organization. That study ranks Montana as the 38th best, or put differently, the 13th worst. In fact, the positions of several states in the region are reversed in comparison with the first column. North Dakota and Wyoming have among the worst tax climates by the cost measure. How can this be? The answer is, going back to natural resources again, the answer is that the cost study measures tax climate by revenues from taxes on business, with higher revenues indicating a worse tax climate. The reason that North Dakota and Wyoming rank so poorly is that they were, at the time of the study, and North Dakota still is, collecting enormous amounts of natural resource revenues. But that doesn't mean that the tax climate is bad for other non-resource businesses. In fact, we have seen that property tax rates are very low in Wyoming, and it doesn't have any income tax at all. How can this indicate a bad business tax climate? This is the last data slide. I promise you, the format is familiar to you by now, except we have twice as many columns here. Oh, no, we don't either. Okay. This slide compares estimated direct taxes on families, that is personal income taxes, sales taxes, residential property, and auto taxes, for hypothetical families of three at two different income levels, $25,000 on the left and $150,000 on the right, in the largest city in each state. At the $25,000 income level, Montana's taxes are among the lowest in the country, at 7.5% of income, in comparison with a national average of 10.6%. So we rank 47th highest. One reason for this is the absence of a sales tax. The average family in the country pays almost $1,000 in general sales taxes at this income level. However, some other states have low tax burdens on households at this income level, even though they do have a sales tax. For example, Minnesota, not shown in the table, and I'll probably get a question about this because I didn't write it down, Minnesota has a 6.875% statewide sales tax plus local add-ons, but a family at this income level has a lower total tax burden than in Montana. The reason is a substantial refundable income tax credit, similar to the federal earned income tax credit. Look now at the right-hand portion of the table. At the $150,000 income level, Montana's taxes remain below average, but at 8.8% versus 9.8%, but our rank moves up from 47th to 37th. South Dakota and Wyoming have much lower taxes at the higher income level because neither state has an income tax. And North Dakota has used a portion of its Bakken revenues to lower other taxes, including the income tax. Those resource revenues are great when you have them. One other thing to notice is the change in tax rates between the $25,000 income level and the $150,000 income level. This is one way of looking at the fairness of the tax system. The change in tax rates is a measure of the progressivity of the overall state and local tax structure. In Montana, the tax rate increases from 7.5% to 8.8%. Not a big increase, but greater than zero. In most other states, and for the nation as a whole, state and local taxes decline as a percentage of income as income increases, indicating a regressive tax structure. Look at the bottom. On average, the tax rate goes from 10.6% at the $25,000 income level to a smaller 9.8% at the $150,000 income level. And as I said previously, the structure of the income tax, particularly how it treats low-income families, is more important for progressivity than whether or not it has a sales tax. So what do these findings suggest about possibilities for tax reform in Montana? Well, if Montana wishes to provide substantial property tax relief and at the same time compensate for the loss of resource revenues and provide funding for infrastructure and other services, it will need to find additional revenue elsewhere. Some additional income tax revenue would be garnered from adjusting rates and brackets and eliminating some deductions and credits, but Montana's income tax is already above national and regional averages. Proposals for sales taxes are again under discussion. They range from expanded taxes on tourists to local option sales taxes to a statewide general sales tax. The latter option would generate the most revenue and therefore provide both for property tax relief and revenue adequacy. Sales taxes take a larger share of income from the poor than the rich. This regressivity could be offset with an expanded refundable income tax credit for low-income Montanans. A sales tax has been a controversial issue in Montana for decades. Governor Tim Babcock proposed a sales tax in the 1970s that was defeated. The very popular Governor Mark Roscoe supported a sales tax referendum in the 1990s. It was voted down 3-1. Will some sort of a sales tax be adopted this time around? We'll have to wait and see.